Gaelic is a Gaelic word that's used to describe an almost barren but large pinnacle of a rock island that rises directly out of the water. In this case, some 750 feet out of the ocean, about 10 miles off the coast of southwest Ireland. Skellig Michael is only a half mile long, and at no point is it more than 500 yards wide, but very, very steep. There are actually three of these small rocky islands, and one of them is named Michael, Skellig Michael, because according to tradition, when St. Patrick was banishing the snakes from Ireland, the snakes were actually, of course, demons, you know. The Archangel Michael appeared here on Skellig Michael with a host of angels to join in the spiritual battle. A small monastery is perched on Skellig Michael, composed of six stone huts, the famous beehive cells of Celtic monks, clustered around a chapel. The interior of these cells was roughly 15 by 12 feet, without windows, constructed from the stone that lay loosely about on the skellig. And you probably know that other versions of these beehive cells are found scattered all over Ireland. St. Finian, who was from the same monastery as St. Brendan the Navigator, founded this monastery on Skellig Michael. He and a handful of monks had a blessing from the abbot to go on peregrinatio, holy pilgrimage. And they set out in their little boat with sails but no oars. And they waited for God's wind to carry them out to sea, not knowing where they would end up, not knowing if they would even live, carrying with them only food and water for 7 days. By God's will, they ended up on the no man's island of Skellig Michael. And for the next 600 years, monks lived and died there on this hair-raisingly precarious site. You have to see pictures of it to appreciate what an awesome experience this would have been for them. To reach its three terraces just below the summit of the peak calls for nothing less than recognized rock climbing skills. To give this a bit of historical perspective, when the hermitage at Skellig Michael was established by Celtic wanderers, Mount Athos and Meteora in Greece had not even been dreamed of, and it would still be more than 500 years before Russia was converted to Orthodox Christianity. That's how ancient this is. Another form of martyrdom were those who chose to live as strict anchorites, as I already had mentioned above. When Saint Dulach announced his intention to live as a hermit beside a church in County Dublin at the beginning of the 7th century, he set down a plan which has survived for us for the anchor hold, as it was called, and how he and any successor would dwell in it. And there were anchorites, men and women, all throughout the British Isles, well into the Middle Ages. There's a very famous one that comes after the schism that probably many of you have heard of by the name of Julian of Norwich. Saint Dulog said that his was to be built of stone 12 feet long and 12 broad with three windows. One, it was attached, you see, to the side of the church. And so one of the windows looked into the choir, the clerios, what we would call the clerios in the Eastern Church. And it was through there that the anchorite would follow the divine services and would receive Holy Communion through that window. And then there was another window on the opposite side through which he could receive his food. And then there was a third just for light. The window for food was secured by a bolt, and it had opaquely glazed glass, very early primitive form of glass, which could be opened and shut because no one should be able to look in, nor should the anchorite have a view out. The hermit was to be provided with nothing but a jar, a towel, and a cup. After a third hour, around 9 a.m., he was to lay the jar and the cup outside the window on the ledge and then close it. About dinner time, he was to see if his food was there, and if it was, he was to sit at the window and eat and drink. When he had finished, whatever remained was to be left outside for anyone who might choose to remove it, and he was to take no thought for the morrow. But if it should happen that there was nothing for his dinner, he was not to omit his accustomed thanks to God, as if he had had a feast, even though he went hungry until the next day. His garments were to be a gown and a cap, which he was to wear waking and sleeping. Sounds like monastics. In winter, he might, if the weather was severe, wear a woolly cloak, because he was not allowed to have any fire except what his candle produced. Now that we have a sense of what is good and true about the Celts, and what is modern wishful thinking and myth-making, we come at last to St. Brendan the Navigator, who can only be understood in the context of pilgrimage or peregrinatio, and this leads us, in turn, to the Celtic monks here in North America. You know, about 50 years ago, some thoughtful scholars began to suspect that the early medieval narrative called the Voyage of St. Brendan the Abbot, the Latin title is Navigatio Sancti Brendani Abbatis. They began to suspect that this wasn't a fairy tale or a pious fable or a fanciful myth at all, but that it was an account of an actual journey taken by St. Brendan and a number of his monks from Ireland to North America, complete with accounts of what we can today easily identify as volcanic eruptions in Iceland and great whales at sea and even icebergs, but things which they had never seen before or experienced. So they didn't have the same terminology for those things that we have, but they described them accurately. Initially, this interpretation of St. Brendan's voyage was dismissed. It seems that many scholars and entrenched professors in our universities and colleges spend a lot of time dismissing things, especially things that trouble their pet theories. They dismissed it because they doubted that anyone could have crossed the Atlantic with the kind of primitive boat that was known to have been used by the early Celtic sailors. They doubted, that is, until in the 1970s, the British explorer Timothy Severin successfully crossed the ocean in a duplicate of St. Brendan's craft, proving beyond a doubt that the Irish monks could have sailed their leather boats to the New World before the Norsemen and long before Columbus. Therefore, St. Brendan's voyage was no mere splendid medieval fantasy, but it was a highly plausible tale founded upon real events and real people. But still, at that time, there was no actual evidence to show that anyone from Europe had been here as early as the 6th century, when St. Brendan had made his voyage. And then, in the early 1980s, a petroglyph was decoded here in West Virginia through the work and efforts of Dr. Pyle, who, as you know, will be here this afternoon, who hadn't set out to prove anything at all about the Celts. He actually knew almost nothing about them initially. He just wanted to scientifically and objectively determine, if possible, what this particular petroglyph was all about. And this is the place where Dr. Pyle's story begins, which will be the subject of his talk this afternoon. But from all of this, one can see that if Celts were here in North America, they would have been monks on pilgrimage, heroic men, following their hero Jesus Christ through penance and asceticism and solitude and pilgrimage that was intended as an exile in honor of the Lord Jesus Christ. These monks were part of a church characterized by a gentle way of life and yet found in austere monastic settlements and island retreats dominated by the personalities of saints and expressed in poetry and liturgical hymns. In the words of one historian, all of this can be summed up as the, quote, Christian ideal in a sweetness which has never been surpassed. I would like to close with these excerpts from St. Brendan's hauntingly beautiful prayer about giving it all up for Christ. Quote, shall I abandon, O King of Mysteries, the soft comforts of home? Shall I turn my back on my native land and my face towards the sea? Shall I put myself wholly at the mercy of God? Shall I throw myself wholly on the King of Kings, without food and drink, without a bed to lie on? Shall I say farewell to my beautiful land, placing myself under Christ's yoke? Shall I leave the prints of my knees on the sandy beach, a record of my final prayer in my native land? Shall I then suffer every kind of wound that the sea can inflict? Shall I take my tiny boat across the wind and sparkling ocean? O King of the glorious heaven, shall I go of my own choice upon the sea? O Christ, will you help me on the wild waves? In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. I want to say to you that I am not any kind of an expert on the Celts. I'm just someone who has come to this study in the 2 years that I've been here, less than 2 years that since we learned about the Celts here in West Virginia, and have begun to do a lot of reading. And I was thinking the other day, I was telling somebody that if I were a young person, a young man or woman, and I was starting all over in life, parents, please remember this, I would become an expert on the Celts. I would become a Celtic archaeologist, anthropologist, historian. I would learn all those ancient languages, Gaelic and Ogham and all of it, because this is a field that is just waiting for young people to get into and explore and reveal to the rest of us. There's so much to know, so much to learn. It's very exciting. And I'm too old to do that now, but I encourage young people, anyway, anyone younger than I am, to start. And I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have for the next few minutes before we take our break. But I want to tell you in advance that if you ask questions specific to the petroglyphs here and other archaeological evidence that has been discovered, we need to defer those questions to Dr. Pyle, because that is his special area of expertise. Yes?
Father, there's a creation scientist by the name of Bill Cooper who published a book that I read called After the Flood. And in the book, he claims that according to Welsh documents that were discovered by Geoffrey of Monmouth in the 12th century, he was trying to preserve the Welsh history that predates the conquering of the Romans in 55 BC and all the rest. Anyway, my question is that he claims one of the disadvantages of the arrival of the Roman or St. Augustine of Canterbury was this slaughter of monks in Bangor. I wanted to look it up because he's Protestant, but he is sympathetic to the idea that we're descended from Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and I'm wondering. Of course, the other big question is the relationship between Romans and the Celts, too, if you could address that.
That's a very good question. It's an interesting one. A lot of people don't know that there was Christianity in the British Isles long before St. Augustine of Canterbury arrived on a mission sent by St. Gregory the Great, who was the Bishop of Rome at that time in the 5th, 6th century. Christianity had already been there for quite a long time, initially with the Celts. And then, of course, after the Celts began to die out and the Saxons, the Anglo-Saxons, began to move into the British Isles, of course, the pure Celtic Christianity began to recede. But still, there were many things that survived in the Saxon church. And all that continued and was thriving. It was a whole culture and church thriving throughout the British Isles until St. Augustine of Canterbury arrived on this mission. Now, what we have to keep in mind is that St. Augustine didn't know that there was already a fully developed and fully fledged Christian church in the British Isles. He thought that he was going as a missionary to a completely pagan land. And so when he arrived, he was extremely surprised and shocked to find out that there were Christians there that had already been there. But he was very distressed to find out that they did a lot of things differently from the way they were done by the Church of Rome on continental Europe. Well, keep in mind, however, this is well before the schism between the East and the West. And so the church, the Roman church on the continent at that time was still completely one in faith and doctrine with the Eastern Church, the Orthodox Church. So it wasn't a question necessarily of Rome being right and the British Isles being wrong, or Rome being wrong and the British Isles being right. It was a question of legitimate differences, which existed much more in the early church than we sometimes realize. And Augustine didn't know what to do with this. He wrote back to St. Gregory the Great, who was great, a very great father of the church, and he asked for advice because he saw that these Christians in England, especially in disciplinary issues, they handle things differently than he was used to from the continental Roman church. And in a masterpiece of patristic wisdom, St. Gregory replied that he was to leave in place all those local customs that were that had existed for a long time already among these Christians in Britain. Anything that was good and true and noble and holy and beautiful and so forth, he was to leave those things untouched, that these were legitimate variations. Unfortunately, by the time that letter got back to St. Augustine, all kinds of trouble had already erupted, and Augustine had launched himself on a crusade to compel the British Christians to submit, to conform. And that was really the beginning of the end of whatever was left of the old Celtic Christianity in Britain. But we have to be very careful here to realize that this was not, again, because Rome was right and the British Isles were wrong, or vice versa. This is a tragedy, a historical tragedy that took place because largely out of ignorance. But it was certainly the beginning of the end. But it's interesting, if you read Sir Walter Scott's novel Ivanhoe, which those of us of a certain age all had to read when we were in high school, if you remember Ivanhoe, you remember that the character of Ivanhoe, the main character of the novel, is the son of one of the last Saxon lords or noblemen in Britain. And they've held to the old religion and the old ways, and they did not want to conform to things being done by the Norman kings who had been imported from France, who were very, that was the Norman church and the Latin church, and by then we already have a very oppressive Roman church imposing itself on Britain. If you don't know about that and what had been going on in Britain for hundreds of years before that, that the whole special tension that existed between the Norman kings, Richard the Lionhearted and King John, and on the other hand, the Saxon remnants that were there, it escapes you. You miss it altogether. It's a subtle thing, but it's very much present in that novel. Sir Walter Scott understood it. But lots of young people today don't know much about early British history, so they miss that. Yes?
You might mention the Council of Whitby.
Yes, the Council of Whitby is another sort of cutoff, sort of watershed date. The Council of Whitby, Whitby is on the west, the east coast of England. And this was a council that was summoned to deal with a whole variety of issues, primarily disciplinary, also having to do with the setting of the date of Easter and so forth, because the church in the British Isles did not celebrate Easter or Pascha, as we call it, on the same date as continental Europe. And this was a period of time when, in both the East and in the Western parts of Christendom, there were efforts being made to try and standardize things so that Christians would be celebrating the great feasts at the same time. Anyway, this council really sort of was a drawing of a line in the sand in terms of putting an end to many perfectly legitimate variations, local usages that had survived in the British Isles, and vigorously, aggressively replacing those things with more conformist, continental European Roman ways of thinking and doing things. The Council of Whitby is a whole study all its own that we can't go into too much, but it's something worth your looking up and reading about if you're interested in the subject. Michael?
I know when St. Patrick first went into Ireland, he confronted a lot of Druids and these people that had these old mystical beliefs. And I was wondering how a lot of those people had converted to Christianity, right? So I was wondering sort of how much of that old mystical baggage remained or was ever carried over.
Yes. Did you all hear this question? It was a very important one. No. The question was, when St. Patrick came to Ireland, of course he encountered the pagans there, the Druids and such like, and converted many of them to Christianity. And the questioner was wondering how much of ancient sort of pagan mysticism and so forth survived in and came into Christianity. It's a very good question. It's an important question because many people who are involved in the New Age movement today believe that a lot of what was going on in the Celtic Church was simply a baptized form of Druidism. But actually, from what I've been able to determine reading, the best and the most recent scholars, is that that's not true. In fact, St. Patrick did tremendous warfare with even with demons and pagan gods and goddesses and so forth. There were great miracles and wonders worked. There were also occasions or situations where St. Patrick and Druid priests would sort of have it out in terms of whose God was the true God. Things straight out of the Old Testament, in fact. And if you read the life of St. Patrick, it's very edifying, very inspiring. But what you see there is that St. Patrick had a very clear understanding of what Christianity was and a very clear understanding of what Druidism and other variations were, and that in confessing Christ as the Son of God and God, that this entailed a whole shift in one's worldview, which he was very intent upon giving to those early to those pagan Druids and others. Now, there are some who say, well, that's a shame, because, of course, nowadays, well, anything pagan is very popular and is considered not just popular but desirable and equal with Christianity and so forth. Well, that's one way of looking at it, of course, but it isn't the way that St. Patrick looked at it, that's for sure, and it's not the way that the early Celts themselves looked at it. Now, I can say, however, that there might have been, probably was, in the ancient, among the ancient Celts, a sort of mystical temperament or character that was undoubtedly passed down from generation to generation in terms of even just in the gene pool, for all we know, which disposed them, as is the case with all nations and tribes on the face of the earth, to bring forth or develop one aspect of human experience, maybe more strongly than others. And we can see this among the Slavs, the Russians, among the Greeks, the Byzantines, among the Latins, those in Gaul, in Ireland, Wales, Scotland. There is something there. And so there might have been a tendency or an openness on the part of the Celts towards spiritual things that was perhaps stronger than it was among some other Christians in the West at that time. But I have to say that it's difficult to imagine this whole idea of peregrinatio, of pilgrimage, of just casting yourself adrift, just trusting that God will lead you someplace, even if it's just to death. It's difficult to imagine that wasn't based upon this utter abandonment to the providence of God and trust in his providence in our lives, which so few of us have to even a small degree anymore. Yes?
When did St. Patrick live?
St. Patrick, the exact dates I don't know, but it's 6th century. Does anybody have a more exact date? Yes?
He began his ministry in 432.
Earlier, okay.
In Ireland.
Okay, good. So very early. We have time for any more questions, Father? Is that it? Okay. We have to stop the questions because we have to allow a little time for people to stretch before the lunch is served. Okay.